I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome to another one of our Urbanite Radio stories. But this is a story that we've been dying to do for a while since this book came out. The book is the John Carlos story, of course, written by the great John Carlos, with Dave Zirin, who has been on the show many times. He's written The People's History of Sports in the United States, What's My Name, Fool, Bad Sports. His show is The Edge of Sports. And John and Dave, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Great to be here. Thank you.
So I got to tell you a little story first, John, why this book meant so much to me, because the backstory of this about you and the movement and the struggle was very powerful, because you're maybe an inch older than me, but I remember 1968, because in 68, in the early part of 68, I was in Mexico on my way to Cuba when I met all these Mexican students who were then in September, before the Olympics, all murdered and mowed down, people who became my friends. And then I remember your movement before you went to the Olympics, trying to stop it. And then I remember you at the Olympics. This is when I saw this book and the background. I just want to say that it's an honor, and I'm glad you put this down on paper at last.
Thank you so much.
So let's just start. You know, this is one of the things I think is important here is for you to talk a bit about you in terms of, this is just not a moment in time for you, that you growing up in Harlem as like a young Robin Hood of the streets, this idea of the struggle and the battle for human rights and dignity as a black man is something that's in your bones, and was in your bones since a childhood.
Yes, yes. Well, there's many things that maybe keep my eyes open wide, you know, and I learned the metaphor from that is to see what your ears and hear what your eyes. You know, I didn't miss too much as a kid in terms of when I noticed as a very young boy about white flight. I noticed that in the various agencies in New York, we didn't have any representation of people of color. Like, I think we had two detectives in all of Harlem that were black. We didn't have any firefighters that was people of color at that particular time. Educators, we didn't have as many black educators as possible. We didn't have any representation of people of color relative to history, American history on the walls anywhere. There was many things that I had concern about in terms of how individuals were treated. I noticed they would treat one ethnic group a certain way and then go back and treat the other ethnic group a very different way relative to a white individual based on the fact that the individual might have been Hispanic or individual might have been Jamaican or Cuban or what have you. They treated them all together different. So I had a very very strong foundation in that area in terms of trying to educate myself as to why these things were taking place, and at the same time to look and see who was standing fast to try and change these things. And those individuals I can count on probably, for me at that particular time, 3 to 4 fingers.
And when you were a kid in Harlem, you have this great quote in the book here, when you did your Robin Hood gig, which you can talk about, and your boys asked you what we were going to get paid, and you said, man, we're going to go over those freight trains and see what those guys have inside, and we're going to circulate in the community. And when you got there, you told them, all right, fellas, load up and get those boxes on your shoulders and let's run. So you ran with these 25-pound boxes of food from the freight trains back to the streets of Harlem and gave the food out.
Right. Well, it was necessary because, you know, when the drug epidemic hit Harlem, there was many parents missing in action. The families became very fragmented at the time. Those that was supposed to be the captain of the ship or the father of the household, a lot of them had succumbed to drugs. Therefore, the moms right there, they was trying to hold on as best they could. If you notice back at that time, for a black parent, collectively they would make maybe $15,000 together. They might have had 4 kids, 5 kids. And how do you feed these individuals? Most of them didn't have food in the fridge, nor did kids have the proper winter mackinaws, you might say, for the winter weather. So it was a lot of thuggery and thievery going on in terms of one stealing another one's coat, not because I'm a thug, just because I'm cold. And I just felt like it wasn't necessary that we would have to live like that. And then I realized back in Robin Hood days in terms of what Robin Hood would do and why he would do it, to the point where Robin Hood says two laws, there's man's law and there's God's law, and I'm concerned about pursuing God's law. I like that theory that he had, not pursue the same law. And don't get me wrong, because my mother and father were upstanding Americans. They believed in the law, believed in doing the right thing. but this was greater than the law that they was following.
Now, and but the funny thing was, the kind of twist of fate was the one of the few black cops in Harlem, the two who caught you one day, the ones that helped you get into the world of track, which set you on a different world.
Well, those two individuals were friends of my father's as well, and they went to my father and told my father, see, there's some break-ins over the freight trains and freight yards, and we think that John is involved in it, and you need to tell him. And my dad actually stopped him and told him, said, no, that's your job. You need to tell him. And he's over at McCombs Park, over there where they built the new Yankee Stadium today. And they came and they circled the whole park and walked up on me and told me, say, John, we need to talk to you. Told my two buddies to go sit up against the fence. And they took me in the infield on the track and expressed to me that there was some break-ins. We couldn't do anything to the individual until we catch him. And then they leaned very close into my face and said, and we're going to catch him. But in the meantime, we have something else to tell you, that you have a talent. And when they said you have a talent, what's that? They said I was a runner. I kind of smirked. And Mr. Bryant was like 6'6". Mr. Lester might have been 6 feet. And when I heard Mr. Lester say that I had a talent, I kind of smirked. And Mr. Bryant smacked me upside my head until I saw stars. Don't you disrespect Mr. Lester. And I said, Mr. Bryant, I'm not disrespecting him. But he said that I'm a runner. And I said, any woman that get up purse snatcher, run them down and get a purse back. And I said that based on the fact that my mom was going to work one night, and she came back to the house about an hour later with her legs all scarred up and bleeding, stockings all torn up, and my father had a great concern. And my mother told my father that somebody had snatched her purse, and he was concerned about her safety. He said, she said, I'm all right, but I got my purse back. So it kind of made me think that my mother ran that person down to get her purse back, and other women have done the same thing in the past, too. He said, no, you're special. And that's how my career started. They gave me a telephone number to Mr. Joe Yancey and the New York Pioneer Club, and from there on, the rest is history.
And it is history. And before we get to the history that kind of made you famous and what it means to all of us now, and by the way, folks, the voice you're listening to is the voice of the great John Carlos. We're talking about the book, The John Carlos Story, that John wrote with Dave Zirin, who's also on the phone with us. And this is one of our Urbanite Radio stories in this hour of the Mark Steiner Show here that you're listening to on WEAA. So let's jump ahead a bit and look to this year of 1968, when you came across Dr. Harry Edwards, a great figure in our history, and the Olympics are about to begin, and what you all, as one of the athletes, you knew you were going to the Olympics. Nothing could really stop you. They could try, but you were too fast. But there was a movement building. You were part of it. Tell the story of what happened with Dr. Edwards and the movement you were building before the Olympics ever happened.
Well, you know, I was going to school at that particular time at a university in Texas called East Texas State University, which is now modern time Texas A&M of Commerce. I was going to school there. It was a very racially charged environment at that particular time. It wasn't suited for John Carlos, and after a year's time, I left East Texas State and went back to New York. I got a call from Harry Edwards stating that, man, there's a meeting taking place. You're invited to the meeting, and after the meeting, Harry said, John, I think I can get you in school in San Jose. And I matriculated on out to San Jose. I was impressed when I was going to East Texas State that I would go to track and field news and read about these guys talking about a potential boycott. Now, not only was I impressed with the fact that they were talking about that, but I was impressed that they was the top of the line. They was the cream of the crop in the Pacific field of track and field. So, quite naturally, I was excited about going down there because it looked like they had their finger on the prize. And I always like to use this metaphor here to say that those guys was the bomb, but a bomb is no good if you don't have the wick to bring the fire. And that's what my job was, to bring the fire to this situation, to try and educate as many young individuals at that time that was involved or hopeful to make the Olympic team, to make them understand that, yes, you have 15 minutes in the sun, and this is what we all train for, to be there one day for that 15 minutes. But we feel, based on our views, that we can make a better society for all people if we choose possibly to step back and not have that 15 minutes, to make a statement to society that something is broke, and as a society, it's our responsibility to try and fix it. For all these young individuals to sacrifice that Olympic movement at that particular time would have made a monumental statement. But yet and still, in retrospect, when you sit back and think about it, God knew what he was doing because the boycott never came about. And I think nothing would have been greater than the demonstration by Mr. Smith and I.
Now, on the way there, I mean, there was a character besides the great Dr. Harry Edwards, who was a revolutionary sports figure in many ways in America in that period, who kind of was leading this group. There was also the kind of the antagonist in this whole thing, Avery Brundage. I think that we forget who ran the Olympics back then. I mean, you were the Olympic Project for Human Rights, but he ran the Olympics from the time he gave them to Hitler to what happened with South Africa. Talk a bit about him and his role in this and the tension and conflict that happened around that.
Well, you know, when you sit back and you think about history relative to the 36 Olympics, you know, this individual here, Hitler, was probably one of the worst species that ever was born into this world. And for Avery Brundage to come up and come back to America and tell Americans that, hey, Hitler is a good guy. He's my friend. Germany's all right. We should bring the games to Germany because they are fair-minded people. We felt that Avery Brundage had to be off his mind, out the window with his thought process. And then you go back and you say, oh, okay, not only did he do what he did to, you know, Jesse Owens and vilifying him based on the fact that he was a Hitler component, but Avery Brundage also was the same individual that stripped Jim Thorpe of his medals. And incidentally, Jim Thorpe and Avery Brundage was in the same Olympics. Avery Brundage was a competitor at the same Olympics that Jim Thorpe was in. And then for him to come back merely because Jim Thorpe was a American Indian and classified as the greatest athlete of his era, but for Avery Brundage to come back and say, well, we're going to strip you of all your awards, we're going to strip you of all your Olympic fame and records and so forth, merely because you took $2 for playing a baseball game, a minor league baseball game for $2 to support your family, we thought it was ludicrous. We thought it was ludicrous that Avery Brundage would come back and say that black athletes did not have the right to step up and say that I have a concern about humanity. All of these were factors in terms of us saying that this guy is off the chart with this nonsense, and it's time for him to take a seat and to take a back seat because he was definitely out of line with what he was doing in his time.
And then you decided to go to the Olympics. I love the little piece in the book where you talk about when you knew the boycott wasn't going to work. Well, let me take a step back. So there's so many little pieces to this on your way to the Olympics. I think that people don't know about your story we should share. Again, the role of Dr. Harry Edwards, but that how Martin Luther King was a huge symbol to everybody who's struggling to make a better America, but especially to your family, and he showed up at this meeting you were in.
Well, actually, what happened, this was shortly after I returned back from East Texas State, and I was helping my mom. My mom was painting the kitchen, and I was there painting the kitchen with it, and the phone rang, and it was Professor Edwards on the phone, and he asked my mother, was I there, talked to me, and told me, he said, John, you know, there's a meeting taking place in downtown the New Yorker Hotel, and people asked me to invite you to the meeting. And I asked my mom, I said, Mom, they invited me to this meeting. You think you can handle it yourself? And she said, well, son, if they invite you to the meeting, it's important that you be there. And I went. And when I went to this meeting, you know, you go there, you're young, you're idealistic, and I went into the hotel, looking in the hotel, the lobby, and looking at all the furniture and the chandeliers, and I'm thinking in the lobby, man, my mama can use all this furniture. And my mom was like a perfectionist. I said, all this would look good in the house. And then once I floated that on out my mind, I went there and I asked for SCLC, and they directed me to a room. I went there and I knocked on the door. The fella came to the door, was Andrew Young. I was starstruck because it looked just like Andrew Young, but I anticipated Andrew Young being 6 feet or above. And when I saw, you know, his height threw me off. You know, it really rocked me because I thought he was a lot taller. But he was very hospitable, invited me in, asked me would I like to have soda, drink, sandwich, cookies, whatever. And I sat there kind of nervously because I felt like I was out of my element. When you sit back and you see all these icons that you saw on TV, you know, that were rolling with Dr. King. But being young and being a little, I guess, a little excited at the time, I didn't put the dots together to really realize where I was until about 20 minutes later when the door opened in the bedroom in that room and out walked Dr. King. And literally my lip fell in my lap. I mean, I was in a state of shock. How could John Carlos be in the room with Dr. King? This is my mother's idol. My mother thought that Dr. King was God's first lieutenant he sent to this earth. And I'm thinking right away, God, my mother needs to be a rock in my pocket or a bug on my lapel. And things that he said in the meeting was profound. Even today, for him to come out and say that he wanted to come out and support the Olympic boycott, and then in the midst of it say that you know, make a statement that they sent him a letter, and in this letter they told him that they had a bullet with his name on it, and he wouldn't have to wait long for it. So after the meeting was over, these things was burning in my mind, and he asked, "Do I have any questions?" Well, of course I had questions. First question is, why would you come out and participate in the Olympic boycott? You're in the civil rights movement. Why would you deal with that? You're not a sports person. And he told me it was a very good question. He said, "John," he said, "I can't shoot pool." He said, "But the answer is," he said, "just imagine if you was in a rowboat and you roll out to the middle of the lake, and then you sit there and the water gets still, everything's serene, and then you go down into the boat and you pull out a rock and drop it." He said, "What happens?" I said, "It creates vibrations." He said, "Absolutely, waves." He said, "When them waves come, everything in that lake notice something is going on, something is happening." He said, "Not only those in the lake," he said, "but those on the shore, they realize that something is happening as well." He said, "Now, just imagine that rock being the Olympic boycott, the Olympic protest." He said, "This will ring out throughout the world that we have some serious issues that we need to deal with, and even greater than that, John, is we'll not take any violence to bring this to the attention of the world." And this is why he wanted to support the boycott. The next thing was, I asked him, I said, "Well, Dr. King, if they threaten your life, why would you go back to Memphis?" And he says to me, he said, "John, that's a better question." And then when he was telling me the answer to this, I had shades on, and I remember pulling my shades down on my nose because I wanted to look in his eyes through my eyes, no glass in between. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking for fear. When a man tells you that someone threatened his life, you think he would be a little concerned and shaky about that. There was no fear whatsoever. I said, "Why would you go, Dr. King?" He said, "I would have to go, John, to stand for those that can't stand for themselves, and I would have to go and stand for those that won't stand for themselves." That was a very strong answer. Stand for those that can't stand for themselves, those that's being oppressed and held down, and those that's in the corporate world that might have an opportunity to step up and speak but won't speak. I have to go there and stand for both factors. And when he said it, it kind of made my life well-rounded, because I used to do those things, but I never had a meaning in terms of why I was doing it. I was just doing it because I thought it was the right thing to do.
This is John Carlos. We're here with him and Dave Zirin. Maybe just a quick question, Dave. I know you'll stay for a little while longer after John has to roll, but I just have to take a segue here and come back to John, the story. How did you two hook up and meet and get to this? You end up writing this story with John, his story.
I mean, I was working for a very small newspaper, the Prince George's Post, African-American-owned paper, back in 2003. And that was the 35th anniversary of the Black Love Salute. And I'm from New York City. The only thing I knew about John Carlos at this particular time, other than his athletic pedigree, was that he was from New York City. And so I thought it would be just very interesting just to talk to him. So I did a Google search for his name. I didn't no idea how to get in touch with John. And a website came up with a phone number at the bottom. And I called the phone number thinking it might be like a manager or something like that. And the number went straight to John, who was in his office at the Palm Springs High School, where he was working as a guidance counselor. So John just picks up the call right there and just says hello, and I didn't have any of my questions ready. I had to do it on the fly. And we did this interview together, and the interview itself got a great deal of traction. I know John got a great deal of positive response from it, and after that it just became very, very regular for me to call upon John if I was going to speak on a panel or if I needed a quote. And one of the things that really, really was bracing for me was seeing John in front of an audience. I mean, he's a tremendous, tremendous public speaker. And so hearing John's stories and also seeing his ability to communicate those stories, I mean, that to me was then a no-brainer. And when we thought about doing this book together, ooh, I mean, it was magic.
There's no doubt in your mind at that point. So John, we're here. We are on the cusp of the Olympics, and you're down in one of the things that hit me with your story. There's so many things in this book that really struck me. When Harry Edwards decided he was not going to go to Mexico, and was going to stay because of death threats, and you were angry at him. But he said later you realized as you got older how right he was to take care of himself and his family. That growth thing was really interesting to me when you said that in the book.
Well, we found out years later that it was a conspiracy to actually connect us with the young individuals that lost their lives down there in Mexico.
Right.
He was actually trying to get, you know, Professor Edwards, Professor Knowles, Tommy Smith, Lee Evans, and John Collins to make an early move to go down to Mexico City to support those individuals, and they can clean house all at the same time. Fortunately for us, God stepped in and prevailed and blocked us from going down there ahead of time, and we went with the team. You know, so a lot of people was disenchanted, you know, said, well, Harry was pushing the boycott and this, that, and the other. He should have been there to lend support to us down in Mexico City. And quite naturally, being young, you would think the same thing until you think your way through it and realize that he did the right thing. I respect Harry Edwards by the highest level in terms of who he is. Most people don't realize that, you know, what went on behind the scenes in terms of the threats from the government, in terms of being vilified by the corporate world, in terms of being vilified by the educational institution, for individuals to put threats upon his life or all of our lives. You know, a lot of people don't know that, you know, Harry had a big black German Shepherd. They stabbed his dog up so bad, left him dead in his doorway, and let him know that he's next. You know, these are the type of things that we had to go through. You know, to sit back and think about the fact that my wife couldn't take any more and took her life as a result of what was going on, or my kids to be subjected to, you know, pain and tyranny in school just merely because, you know, I was their father. So many of these things are taking place, but we don't focus on them as much as we focus on trying to accomplish the deeds that we had before us.
So with many people, everybody in the world knows about the salute that happened after you won the medal. People know the image of the two of you standing there with your fists in the air, black gloves, beads around your neck, and that you were not just vilified, but had your life stripped from you at that point, at least your medals, from the Olympic Committee. So that is known by the world. But what people don't realize is what went behind it. In terms of the preparation, you knew you had to do something.
Well, let me bring you up to snuff. Up to date. That was a prophecy. That was a falsity. It was just total propaganda and lies about them taking our medals away. They never took our medals away. They attempted to intimidate us and tell us they were going to take our medals away. And I stepped forward to tell them, say, you know, this medal doesn't mean anything to John Collins. I said, but the bottom line is, it's my medal. You didn't give me a medal. You didn't tell me it's an open slot on the team. We're going to put you on the team. I earned my way. I met the standard to be on that team. They didn't tell me, say, oh, John, get up on the victory stand because someone else is not in that slot. I had to work through the trials and process of elimination to get there. And for them to come and tell me that they're going to take something, they didn't give me the medal. I earned the medal. And if the medal didn't mean anything to me, it's still my medal, and it might mean everything to my kids. So if you're talking about coming to take this medal, my attitude towards them and expression was to them, bring the militia, because you're going to need them if you're coming to take John Carlson's medal. So in turn, what they did, they lied to the general public for 40-plus years that they took our medals, and that was primarily to intimidate any young individual that say, hey, man, I don't like these blinders that they have on my eyes. I want to turn to the right. I want to turn to the left and see what's happening in my community. I want to look forward and see what's happening in my society. And if I feel that something's wrong, then I might be able to speak on the issues. I have that right. But by the fact that they train these young individuals from babies to go to the Olympic Games is such a great honor, which it is a great honor. But yet and still, it's a greater honor to have concern and emotion and feeling for humanity. And they intimidate those young individuals and say, if you have those emotions and feelings and righteousness, you will lose your Olympic medal. So many individuals ran from that. For years they ran from it. I don't want to make any statement. I don't want to make any scene because they might take my medal away from me. If you think about the atrocities that was happening in China, the most current thing that they did to the American athletes, they had them sign an affidavit stating that they will not say anything public about what was happening over there in China to the various people that was there being tormented and being prejudiced and biased against.
So before you have to roll, just to talk about what happened leading up to that for a minute, then one more question. I know you got to go, but Talk to our listeners just about what you wrote in the book, about what you thought about, what you planned, what happened with you and the both of you and Tommy and your wives, about what you were planning as you got that stand.
You know, leading up to the demonstration, you know, as I stated many times, you know, no one knew about this demonstration with the exception of God, Tommy Smith, John Carlos, and then eventually Peter Norman. After the quarter semi, that's the race just before the final, I made a statement to Tommy that I was disenchanted with the fact that the Olympic boycott was called off, and I felt like I wanted to make a statement. What's your take on that? Mr. Smith said that he was with it. I was so happy and elated to the point when he said he was with it, I had no concern about winning the gold medal. That gold medal had the least amount of thought in my mind. I knew I had to win a medal to get on the victory stand. Then we came together, and I started asking, well, what artifacts we going to bring to the table? He said he had some gloves. At the same time, when he said he had gloves, I realized that this is the first time that the Olympic Games was ever in color, technicolor, to be exact. We wanted to be very clear as the fact that, yes, we represent America, but we represent Black America. And why we were representing Black America, because we felt that Black America never got a fair shake in terms of our deeds that we put together in this society, the history that we've done in this society, the fact that we had to be second-class citizens, the fact that we go to war and fight and represent this country, and when we come on, we still classified as second-class citizens, that we never received the acknowledgement for our heroism in these wars for 50, 60, 70 years later, then we might get some recognition. So we had a concern about them. That's why we put the glove on. Then Mr. Smith had a black scarf on his neck to symbolize black pride for all black people and people of color throughout the world, that we're here and we're representing you and we haven't forgotten you. I wore a black shirt over my USA jersey. A black shirt that I had on was for shame that I had for America. I want to cover up the USA because America had done so many things in its history that was great, but they had done even greater things that was on the negative, a sad, sorry situation that they never chose to step up and say, let's try and resolve these issues. Let's try and apologize for the things that we've done. There's no president in the world, in the United States, in the history of this country that has gotten up and said that they have a sorrow for those individual things that has happened to people of color in this country. Then you sit back and you think, say, wow, he had beads on his neck, which I wore beads out there to illustrate those individuals that was in the South that was lynched or that was raped or that was beaten or tarred and feathered that no one ever said a prayer for or thought for based on, you know, when you sit back and think about the maiden voyage, those individuals that were castrated and thrown overboard and just beat to death, that no one really said that many prayers, but we remembered them. Then we went out there at the same time with black socks and no shoes to illustrate that we still had in the greatest nation in the world. They're going to the moon and landing on the moon, and they telling me that they can't kill a cockroach or they can't kill a rat. And we have kids that don't have food in their fridge at home, and more so we got kids walking 10 and 20 miles a day to and from school and don't even have shoes. And the greatest nation in the world. Someone had to make a statement about this, and we took the opportunity to go to the Olympic Games because we felt it was the greatest vehicle to spread to the world and let the world know that we have issues that we need to deal with. America can show that it's far better than what has been shown all along. Yeah, we put out a facade to the rest of the world, let them know that we was a fair, equal, and just country. But at that particular time, it was not a fair, equal, and just situation, and it's not really that way just yet here in this country. That's why I'm here today to foster these ideas and views to make sure that everybody have a clear understanding as to what's going on. Don't be like those individuals that was there in 1968 that was at the crossroads of their life as to whether they should have boycotted the Olympic Games and couldn't get by the thought that they might have to give up that 15 minutes in the sun. I'm going to have to give up that opportunity to win a medal to make it a better society. The society they was making better wasn't for themselves, because it would have to trickle down and make a better society for their kids and their kids' kids.
John Carlos, I first of all, thank you so much for standing up for the world, for battling through what you've battled through before and after these Olympics, and for being back in the sun again here with all of us with this story. It's been just an honor to have you on this program today.
Thank you so much. I'm honored to be here with you, and always honored to be with my brother David.
And speaking of Brother David,
thank you very much, sir.
Brother Dave Zirin is going to stay with us. We're talking about the John Carlos story, written by John Carlos with Dave Zirin. Dave will be with us right after this break. John, thanks again, man. We look forward to talking to you again one day, and stay strong and be healthy.
Incidentally, for your viewers out there, your listeners out there, I would like to direct them to the johncarlos68.com. Once again, johncarlos68.com is a very provocative page. I think that your kids will get a lot of it, out of it, as well as you adults. I think you'll get quite a bit out of it as well. God bless you, and thank you for giving me this opportunity.
God bless you, brother. Thank you for being with us. And we'll be right back with Dave Zirin, the man who wrote the book with John Carlos. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Mortgage Program, a community lending initiative of the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. 1-800-638-7781. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back. You heard the first part of this program, and everybody knows what happened in the 1968 Olympics when John Carlos and Tommy Smith's Black Power Salute caught the world. And it's deeper than that, though. And the book, The John Carlos Story, was written with Dave Zirin, who has been a guest on the show many times. And Dave, of course, is has his Edge of Sports column and Edge of Sports radio talk show. He's written books like Real Sports, A People's History of the United States, of Sports in the United States, and What's My Name, Fool? And it's always a pleasure to keep him around the show. And Dave, thank you for staying with us here.
Hey, it's great to be here. Thanks so much for having me, Mark.
So, Dave, this is the story. I mean, especially the story that we didn't get to with John just for a minute. When he kept on fighting, kept on running after the Olympics, but they kept coming after him, and he had a rough time. I mean, he really came near the bottom and came back.
Yeah, he really did. And this is what I think makes the story also something that anybody can relate to. And we wrote the story very, very conscious of how it was sculpted, because I've read a lot of sports biographies, and most of them have a similar theme. It's look how great I am, now proceed to genuflect. And even any problems I may have encountered, well, only because of my own personal heroic ability was I able to conquer those problems. And that's really not what we wanted to write. I mean, because John had an ungodly amount of athletic skill. I mean, the guy could run 100 yards in under 9 seconds, for goodness sakes. But what we wanted to convey was this idea of, as John expressed, the principle of standing up for social justice, which you don't need to be an Olympian to be able to do, but also the principle that says if you get knocked down, you got to be able to pull yourself back up, and you can't let the weight of the backlash, not the weight of the world, that sounds cheesy, that sounds like a Barry Manilow song, but the weight of the backlash that people who stand up for social justice almost invariably at some point in their lives have to face. And you can't let that get you down. You have to keep persevering. So John Carlos in the 1970s, I mean, he was it's a tribute to himself. It's a tribute to his family, his faith, everything, that he didn't get sucked into drugs or anything like that, or any sort of very, very serious mental problems, which a lot of people who were thrown to the side after the struggles of the 60s really did struggle with those demons after the fact, after the revolution died. But what John Carlos did instead was he kept his head up, and he kept his head up through a lot of awful things. He kept his head up through his wife, who was by him side throughout 68. They were divorced, and then she took her own life in 1977, and he was raising his kids at that point. So he had to keep his head up through that. He had to keep his head up through his isolation from the international sports community, through the poverty that came from not being able to find work and having to hustle to make ends meet, through harassment by the FBI years after 1968, when he wasn't part of any sort of movement or anything. Still, the FBI felt the need to keep tabs on him and make his life that much more difficult. These were the things he had to shoulder. And in addition to that, he had to make sure that his kids weren't scarred by his own anger. And I'll tell you, one of the most rewarding moments as we've been traveling around with this book is we did an event here in D.C., and John's son was there, who John has always been very close to, and John's grandchildren were there, who are high school athletes themselves of real potential in Manassas, Virginia. And all of them were shocked to hear some of the stories. Mm-hmm. Like, they just didn't know. I mean, they had this vague idea that their grandfather or father put his fist up, but the actual details, the painful details, he made a conscious decision to keep from them for decades. And I think one of the great motivations for John wanting to do this book was that he was done with being silent about his own life, and he really did want to leave behind something so people could really know what he went through. And for me as a writer, just to even play a small role in that is incredibly gratifying.
I can see that, and I can feel it in this book. There's something just I've read all the books you've written, Dave, and this is there's something about this book. I know there was his words, and you helped him put these words together as a book. But there's a passion in here, I think, from both of you that comes through.
Yeah, well, thank you for saying that. I mean, all of that is very conscious, and it was. I mean, doing a book like this, I mean, it means doing a ton of interviews. And then standing there with all these transcribed words and stories and figuring out a way to make it a coherent narrative. And so I think that that's the real challenge, is that, you know, everybody has stories, everybody has experiences, but can we actually sculpt our own lives as a narrative that actually has some value to somebody else, you know, other than a family member who wants to learn more about you? And that's the real goal with this. And I got to tell you, when we did the event here in D.C., afterwards, John's grandchildren were just kind of speechless. And I said to them, I said, hey, you didn't realize all that about your grandfather, did you? And their jaws were on the floor. Mm-hmm. And when one of them just looked at me and he said, it's like I'm learning my granddaddy's Batman. And I always liked that.
I love that. That's great. But this story, the John Carlos story, because it was about sports, about one of the great athletic figures in our history, about somebody who was a revolutionary and a radical, that's the story, I think, in some ways, given what we're going through in America now, should resonate in ways for America in the 21st century.
Yeah. No, I think it resonates for a lot of reasons. I mean, the number one, as I see it, is that these are John's words, not mine. This is what John said at Occupy Wall Street when we spoke there. He said, what we were fighting for 43 years ago has really not yet been won. And I thought that was an interesting statement, because some of the most direct demands in 1968 were won. Like, they wanted apartheid South Africa and Rhodesia disinvited from the Olympics. Well, those aren't apartheid countries anymore. They wanted more African-American assistant coaches hired. Well, that's something that's been accomplished. They wanted Muhammad Ali's title restored. You know, that's something that, of course, happened, and Ali has been re-embraced. And they wanted Avery Brundage to be fired. Now, they didn't win that, but I think anybody with a modicum of historical integrity recognizes that Avery Brundage was a rather monstrous individual during his tenure as head of the International Olympic Committee. Anytime someone can put the phrase pro-Hitler in describing your political views, you're not going to do very well in terms of being judged by history. And yet, even though these things were effectively won, what John was really fighting for back then was this idea of human dignity on an international scale and living in a world without prejudice. And that's what hasn't yet been won. And that's why he identifies very strongly with the Occupy movement. I mean, as he said to a reporter, he said there was no more appropriate place for us in 1968 to make our stand than at the Olympic Games in Mexico City. And there's no more appropriate place for people today to stand up than right here on Wall Street. And he said the pie of despair has gotten bigger.
Yeah, when in the afterword that you put together in the book, I mean, it reflects kind of your thinking about some of the people who are still standing up, and how he has said, and you have said, it's much rarer now for athletes to stand up and demand social, political, economic justice and change.
But you certainly have athletes who do stand up, who do say things, but there are a couple of differences about John Carlos and Tommy Smith that are worth recognizing and emulating for any of today's jocks for justice or aspiring jocks for justice. The first is that they did so as part of a broader movement. And oftentimes when you hear athletes speak out today, whether it's, you know, against Bush's war, several athletes spoke out, or whether it's against the death penalty, as Eitan Thomas has done, it's not connected to a broader social struggle. Even if those social struggles exist, the athlete themselves isn't a part of it. And so that's a real difference in terms of Carlos and Smith. But the other thing that's really different is that they took their struggle right to the field of play itself. And so if we're thinking about what a 21st century version of a Carlos Smith moment would be, I mean, you'd really have to make it something like people going out to half court or midfield of a college football or basketball game. And I'm talking like the star athletes and taking off their helmets and saying that they won't play unless there's more fairness in terms of the NCAA and how it deals with so-called student athletes. And if they did that, you know, it would piss off the thousands of people in attendance. It would piss off the millions of people watching at home. But that's the thing about what Carlos and Smith did, was that they weren't scared to piss people off. And they weren't scared to ruin the party and the escapism of sports for a larger point. And I think that's what people need to realize the stakes are if you want to emulate Carlos and Smith. You will be revered historically, but you will suffer in the short term. And that's a tall order for a lot of folks.
Who do you see in today's world as having that kind of political backbone in the world of sports? Who do you see that emulates John Carlos, Thomas Smith?
Well, I think there's a wide swath of people. I mean, I thought it took a lot of backbone when Charles Woodson of the Packers stood with the striking Wisconsin teachers and the public service workers trying to fight off Scott Walker's cuts last year. I thought that took a lot of courage. I thought that several of the NFL and NBA players, when they spoke out, when they were being locked out, and some of their comments certainly at least gave an indication that there was a broader set of politics at work, like when Pittsburgh Steeler Troy Polamalu, he said that this isn't about billionaires versus billionaires. This is about whether or not the rich are going to be allowed to do whatever they want just because they're rich. And he said that's the way. And he said that's not just the way it is in football. That's the way it is all over. And if somebody has to stand up against it, then let it be the football players. Now he said this before the Occupy movement started. So I thought, you know, that was a very significant statement. But then you have people like Kai Allams, who's the first ever transgendered player in NCAA basketball, played for the George Washington women's team this past fall. And I think these are the things that I look to, and these are the things that really do give me hope. I could talk also about one of the things that I find very hopeful is, you know, professional sports, particularly men's sports, but women's sports as well, has always had a huge, huge streak of homophobia that runs through it. And the fact that you've seen more male athletes speak out against homophobia, doing commercials against anti-gay bullying, being part of the It Gets Better campaign, you know, that to me is very hopeful as well. And then one other thing I'd like to point out is that we have to remember that athletes, I mean, John Carlos certainly is special in terms of that he was a conscious political actor. But we have to remember that when it comes to athletes, oftentimes their symbolic value is very important as well. Like if an athlete came out of the closet, you know, it wouldn't matter if they had no politics at all, or if whether they, you know, they were, you know, Reagan acolytes or you know, Ayn Rand acolytes. I mean, just the mere fact that a player would be out of the closet and playing would make them a political figure. Similarly, look at what's happening right now with the Knicks and Jeremy Lin. Mm-hmm. I mean, it has provoked so much pride and so much anti-racist principle amongst Asian Americans and amongst Asian American allies. It's been remarkable to see. And frankly, a lot of that is independent of Jeremy Lin, the human being, and what he might think in his head or his heart. And there's much more to do about what Jeremy Lin represents and how he makes people feel. That's always existed in the history of sports, and it's something we should keep a close eye upon.
So as you look in your world...
Oh, I'm sorry. Can I say one more thing, Mark?
Go ahead, please. Go ahead.
I just realized it would be obscene for me to do this list and not mention Think Internationally and mention the Hobail brothers, who are the two biggest soccer stars of Bahrain, and the fact that they were actually tortured by the Bahrain royal family's guard for the crime of protesting during the Arab Spring. And Bahrain, of course, a great ally of the United States, so there wasn't any outcry from the United States. But they were interviewed on ESPN. You know, these guys are not only soccer stars of international standing, particularly Alaa Hobail, the older brother, but they are also medics, trained medics. And so they were out there on the street also trying to help the people getting shot down by the Bahrain military and then the Saudi military, because they sent in troops to augment Bahrain. And I mean, the courage of those guys, I mean, my goodness. I mean, that talk about jocks for justice.
Really? I mean, and same thing actually happened in Egypt.
Yes, there was a player, once again, of international standing, who I'm sure your listeners may not be familiar with, named Mohamed Abu Treka, who's probably the most beloved player in the history of Egypt. And he was part of the protests that occurred out there. And he just retired after the riots in Port Said, which most people in Egypt blame the military for, which claimed the lives of 74 people. His team, Alawi, Abu Treka's team, was on the losing end of that particular match. And afterwards, he retired in protest of the violence and protest of the way the military handled the situation. And I mean, this is a person of profound principle.
So when you look at the work you're doing right now, I think that is really important. I mean, you've been kind of a lonely voice talking about pulling together worlds of social change and sports and trying to bring those two together and really highlight some things that people aren't through the edge of sports. But it's getting less lonely, it seems to me. I mean, there are things that are bubbling up that you've mm-hmm. been covering. I mean, I think that I can see kind of a confluence of things happening between your world, in the center of your world, which is between sports and politics. Don't you see that happening?
I feel much less lonely, and sometimes that means I don't get to do as many TV shows as I did. But I never really cared about that and don't care about that. I mean, I love the fact that there is a developing culture in this country of writers and academics and radio hosts who take sports seriously. And I think it's a function of a couple of things. I mean, the first is that sports is now a 24-hour media beast. And the majority of talk on sports radio isn't really about the games at all, but it's people shouting their opinions back and forth. And so with so much oxygen, I mean, the fact that even a sliver of that is devoted to a more intelligent kind of discussion, I mean, that's great. And I think that the second thing is just that there are just too many issues out there that can't be contained on the sports page. I mean, whether we're talking about the Arab Spring and the soccer players, or whether we're talking about the public funding of stadiums, or whether we're talking about the role of women or people of color or Jeremy Lin. I mean, these are issues that demand a more serious and more rigorous kind of discussion. And it still is not exactly common in the sports world. I definitely shouldn't overstate as if there's some kind of renaissance happening of intelligent discourse, because that's not happening. But it definitely is happening more. I mean, there's more of a community that exists both online and in the formal sports media. And I'm very, very, very happy about that, because honestly, it makes my work easier. You know, it makes it easier because I'm reading other people's columns, getting other people's opinions, and that's where you get some really good ideological friction going. Mm-hmm. And that's where greatness is forged. Like, I would venture to say, Mark, that if you were the only talk radio host in all of the East Coast, you know, you might be much better known, but I would argue that your show would probably suffer for it.
I agree.
Because you'd just be like, hey, I'm Mark, and I'm the only one talking. Now I'm going to tell you 10 things that are stuck to my wall. You know,
right.
It would just be
right.
Much less interesting. So it's good to have that kind of healthy, productive kind of competition. Not the kind of competition that's like, let me destroy that other company and throw people out of work, which is usually the competition that's extolled in this society, but like the kind of competition that says, ooh, let's see if I can read your stuff and if I can actually top that by building on the ideas that you're bringing to the table. Especially on this Jeremy Lin issue, I can tell you, it has been such an education for me.
How so?
On everything from, oh my God, because you just realize what you don't know. And then you read other people. It's like there actually is a history of Asian Americans who played in the NBA, history I was largely ignorant of, that I learned by reading other people. And then there was I wrote this other column, and I included an opinion by one writer of Asian descent from the West Coast, who said that one of the reasons, things that makes Jeremy Lin so special, is that there never was a national civil rights movement of Asian Americans. And this has provided a catalyst for a national voice against anti-Asian racism. So I included that in my story. And I got some very thoughtful, very intelligent emails from people saying things like, well, you can't really say that without pointing out that people of Chinese descent were some of the first members of the IWW. People of Asian descent were some of the founding members of the United Farm Workers and the Black Panther Party in Oakland. And, you know, there is this history that for me was not on. I mean, I like to think that I've studied this stuff, but it certainly wasn't on the tip of my tongue when I was assessing and trying to figure out, my starting point was like, why have Asian Americans traditionally been silent in the face of racism? So that's my prejudice coming to it, coming from a point of ignorance because I didn't know the history. But then learning the history, you know, not in a way that has people emailing me like you're an idiot, you don't know anything or whatever, but it's like it's very healthy. And it's like, let's really use this as an opportunity to dialogue and get smarter. And that to me is very, very encouraging.
Yeah, I mean, your columns on this have been really interesting. I love the piece that you wrote about Jeremy Lin and why he's not Tebow.
Yeah. Well, that was important because I think, I got to tell you, I think so much about racism, and this is under-said and under-discussed, but people think that racism is about how white people see people of color.
Right.
When I think most of racism is truly at its core about how white people see themselves and relative to other people. And I think that, you know, like if you think about things like majority of, say, white working class, or the fact that the majority of people on welfare are white, and it's like, and how those racist ideas are really about seeing themselves as at least something better than people of color. And that, of course, is very destructive. You know, as Frederick Douglass said, they separate both to conquer each. And I think in the Jeremy Lin Tim Tebow thing, you see that because you had writers, white writers, bending over backwards to say that Jeremy Lin is the new Tebow. And the more you read the articles, you realize, gee, even though this is phrased in a way as if it's to praise Jeremy Lin, like he's our next sensation, it's really about burnishing the image of Tim Tebow. Is what it's about.
Right.
Because the there's so many differences between Lin and Tebow. The most profound difference, it's not about ethnicity. It's not about the fact that Tebow was a first-round draft pick and Jeremy Lin really was this undrafted guy who was unknown in NBA and in fan circles. It's not about that. The main difference is that Jeremy Lin can actually play his sport. And Tim Tebow is very bad at what he does on the most basic,
right,
objective,
right.
Statistical level. He is not good at what he does. Now, there are similarities in that they're both religious people. They both seem to really, you know, get their teammates excited, and that's all fine and good. But you know who else is religious and gets the team excited? The Philadelphia Fanatic. The mascot at the Philadelphia Phillies game. Very religious guy, gets the fans excited. Doesn't mean you want him out there batting fourth. But Tim Tebow cannot play. And so it's about burnishing Tebow, frankly, at Lin's expense. And I think that's that thing, as if to be like, oh, here's Jeremy Lin, this incredible, emerging, inspiring figure. Well, we have one, too, and his name is Tim Tebow, and he's just as good, if not better. So they go to Tebow, and they're, like, ask him questions, and Tebow, with this condescending look on his face, is like, oh, yeah, I like him a lot. Yep, he's going to learn. Woo, it's quite a roller coaster. And I'm going to say, I bet it's a tougher roller coaster for you, Tim Tebow, because you can't actually play. And so it's all built on this fraudulent premise, which you know, as we saw on several times this year, it seemed to just come crashing down on his head.
Dave Zirin, it's always great to have you on the air with us. This is an especially good day, an hour with you. We've been talking with Dave Zirin, of course, Edge of Sports, and his wonderful website is edgeofsports.com, and he's written this book with John Carlos called The John Carlos Story, who is on with us for the first half hour of this program, and you can also go to johncarlos68.com. Both of those websites will be attached to our website today, so you can go check them out under the show when you get to our website, steinershow.org. Dave, thank you so much. It's always a pleasure and honor to have you on the show with us.
Oh, my privilege. Anytime.
Thank you. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555.